the fisherman. The way the sunlight reflected off the wood paneling reminded the fisherman of his office. He thought he would find that irritating, but on inspection found that it added to his pleasant mood. He was only reminded how far from his office he was. He tried briefly to calculate the miles in his head, and then decided it was against the spirit of the whole thing anyways. It was a long way. That would suffice. 3 o'clock. A familiar angle of sunlight. He'd be brewing his afternoon coffee around now, lingering in the break room, trying to rally from the post-lunch dip. Maybe the Spanish had it right. A siesta. Maybe he'd pay them a visit someday and try it on for size. Hell, maybe he'd sail there post-haste. He tried to calculate again, and decided it was at least definitely more than 1,000. Probably 2. But a straight shot anyway. Did they take siestas in Cuba? Not that he needed to travel abroad to take a nap these days. He undid his watch again and flipped it over and ran his thumb over the nickel battery plate. Ed O'Bannon, etched in script. 1958 to 1989. 31 years. Someone at the party had pointed out that it seemed to imply he was dead. No, but I really did start living the day I started with the firm. It was a weird thing for him to say. He who had always privately maintained that he was only putting on the suit and tie for expediency's sake, and had promised himself that he would always work in order to live, rather than the other way around. At 61, he was getting out 4 years early. The initial plan had been out in 5. He wouldn't need much because he'd be living on a houseboat thereafter. Once the money started coming in, it quickly became 10. And once Mary was born and his last name was on the birth certificate, it got pushed to now. But he felt he still had some life left in him, coming out the other side more or less intact. He knew guys who were going to work until they keeled over on their desk. Some who were proud of it. Some who marched grimly into the office each day with pursed lips like they were serving out a prison sentence. Someone suggested engraving the name of the firm on the watch case to clarify. Masters Granlin and Teague, MGT. It was agreed. He would take the watch in when he returned from his trip and have it altered. It hadn't bothered him until now. Not that anyone would mistake him for 31. Or dead. But there was a chilling finality to it. He placed it in the bedside drawer. He didn't want to know what time it was anyway. Against the spirit of the whole thing. It bothered him some to think that he'd never do all that office stuff again. He didn't know why. Throughout his entire working life, he'd never more than tolerated it, often outright hated it. But it was familiar, and it had, turns out, been his life, after all. The primary stuff of his existence on Earth. The days add up. He let the thought ring around in his head and settle. It was silly to have ever thought it could have been any other way. Did he think he was different from everyone else? It wasn't even a bad career. It was a very fine one. Commendable even on occasion. He wasn't even sure, when he gave it a moment's thought, how he'd have written it any differently if he could have. Eventually, you have to be something after all. You have to pass the days somewhere. So he determined his morose was really only that of, that's it? In a sense that now he was only loitering around, running out the clock. If he'd secretly harbored the notion about retired folk all throughout his youth, he couldn't abandon it now that it was his number being called. If all that little stuff was how he spent the days of his life, and that little stuff was now over, what did that say about his life? Up on deck, he shielded his eyes against the sun and squinted at the sea. Calm and blank in every direction. Cool salt breeze on his face, blowing his shirt back. He had not seen another boat for several hours. Not a spot of land in all that vastness. He tried the radio and could not find a station. Only that morning at sunrise, at the dock, he had been giddily wondering if a week would even be long enough to sate him. The great emptiness settled over him like a wet shirt. A week now seemed like a very long time. He hit the motor to drown out the silence and pushed eastward. He felt the landmass of Florida like a great wall receding at his back, made small by the ocean around it, like a castle oasis in an endless expanse of rolling, waving grassland. When he'd done another 5 miles, he cut the engine and dropped anchor. He finished his lunch, and then he began to assemble his rod, and he baited it, and inside of 5 minutes his lure was in the water. Very soon, a week once more seemed like a reasonable, confrontable length of time, as long as he'd brought enough beer to last it. He couldn't remember the last time he had not seen his wife for a week. Years. He took a beer from the cooler and opened it, and sat watching and waiting well over an hour, and nothing bit, nothing so much as even sniffed his bait, so far as he could tell, but he didn't mind. When he finally decided to give up, the sun was beginning to set, and he moved out several more miles to the east simply because he could. And then he dropped anchor again for the evening and settled in to watch the sunset and drink another beer. The boat was sparkling, he'd made sure of that. Paint job and wax were the capstone on 6 months of work. Not that he'd bought that much of a project. A gift to himself was still a gift after all. But he did have a lot of free time to fill these days, and thought it unwise to undertake something without at least a broad sense of how it all worked. And new boats were, it turned out, rather expensive, and it wasn't as if he had made partner. Not that he was dissatisfied. He was buying a boat, after all. But he'd spread the little amount of repair and upkeep work that there was out at a leisurely pace there was no denying. Several bosses over the years had used that word to describe his work. He knew it was supposed to be an insult, but he never saw it that way. He lit the grill and made sausages and peppers and onions. He wasn't eating bread these days on the advice of his doctor. Well, not really his doctor. A doctor he went to see at the behest of his wife. He hadn't seen one in 10 years. But it wasn't so bad, if bread was all it would take. He opened another beer. The sun finished setting and the sky turned purple and grapefruit and the stars started in, and he could not get used to the quiet. He had to pretend it wasn't there or he'd start to tighten up, like there was an invisible man sitting at the formica table, watching him pull a tray of French fries out of the little oven. The moon came out and it was cut in half, but shone bright as ever, and left a long trace on the calmness of the water. He was glad he came. He decided it. He would adjust to the quiet, to the empty. In a week, he would be sorry to leave it. That feeling he got in his stomach sometimes was just a reflexive reaction that the body took to anything different or new. He'd brought paint and canvases and intended to use the time to teach himself oil paints so that he could bring home a seascape for his wife, if he could not bring her home a marlin. And he'd intended to begin tonight, but the alcohol had made him lazy and he could not tear himself from the deck chair and the stars which were above and around him in clouds. He'd seen nothing like it in his entire life on land, not even up north, not even on his grandfather's ranch near Amarillo. He flipped through the entire dial on the radio and back and shut it off. It was all just waves. He'd visited Mary a few weeks back, and that's what she was saying at dinner. Everything from light on through solid matter, on through us, just at different frequencies. Two of them we use to broadcast sounds, even up into the stars, and we wait to hear something back. We imagine them like us, up there, out there, blindly groping, filled with an existential angst about their place in it all. Or we imagine them like us, colonial pillagers, introducing bumpkin savages to modernity, then immediately crushing them with it. The sausages made him sleepy, and it had been a long day, and he saw no sense fighting it. So he withdrew to his cabin for the night and vowed to get an early start of it in the morning. He closed the door behind him and locked it, and then decided to leave it unlocked instead. It would feel a bit like sleeping naked. If he couldn't sleep with his door unlocked out here, then there was nowhere on earth where he could. He changed and pulled down the comforter and flipped on the bedside table lamp. He would accomplish at least one thing he'd set out here to do. He climbed into bed and opened his copy of Anna Karenina. In 5 pages, he was drifting away. He did not fight it, but managed to turn off the lamp. He awoke in the morning with the customary confusion one experiences on waking up in a strange place. The sun was shining in. Little waves were lapping at his hull. He let his heart slow down and smiled, and then rolled out of bed and went above board. It was earlier than he'd thought, and the sun was still scraping the top of the water. The morning wind was cold on his bare skin, and he went back down and started the stove and made eggs and coffee. A routine, an order of operations, gave him some grounding, something solid to attach to in the middle of all that nothing. He put several lines out behind the boat while the stove was heating, and once he'd eaten, he settled into his fishing chair and opened a beer. He'd bought a bleached white Panama hat for the trip, and he put it on and lit a cigar. He didn't much care if he didn't catch a single fish the entire week. The sun moved across the sky and not much else changed. He snacked on crackers and preserves and drank the lemonade his wife had made. Nothing bit. After lunch, he pulled up anchor and sailed 15 miles farther east. It was hard to believe this existed in the same world as the landbound one he had been planted on. That such profound absence could exist side by side with the world of things. He kept on the throttle and only knew he was moving because he could feel it, the earth passing beneath him, the spray on his face and chest. To the eye, there was little indication, just more of the same, more horizon. More nothing. He stopped and set up and fished for a few more hours before wrapping for the day and retreating to the cabin to prepare his supper. Even the weather had remained conspicuously consistent since leaving Miami. Blue skies from sunrise to sunset. The heavens marveled him again that evening. They'd lost none of their power. And he thought 5 minutes beneath them had been worth the cost of the boat, even if it sank tomorrow. Well, not tomorrow, he thought. Don't sink tomorrow. His wife would love this. But he wasn't sure if she'd want to make the trip out here to see it. She wasn't even keen on his being out here, but said she understood. In bed, he fiddled with the radio to avoid reading because he'd heard AM waves travel farther at night over water. He scanned the dial down and heard nothing. But on the way back, his heart leapt when he heard horns. A break in the static. Big band swing. Was it Count Basie? Hard to tell, it was cutting in and out, teeny and distant and warbled at best. And then it was gone. He'd lost it, sand through his fingers. The next day passed in much the same fashion. Streaks of simmering terror followed by fits of manic bliss. No fish bit. At dawn the day after, the fisherman awoke with a dull headache and a queer twinging in his stomach, and when he emerged on deck, the horizon was broken by a tall sail. Maybe 2 miles away, maybe 3. It was the first interruption in the sameness since he'd left land behind. Was it 2 days ago? Or 3? 4? He eyed the other boat and boiled the water for his coffee, and tried to gauge if it was moving and in what direction. He watched it while he ate his breakfast and finally determined it was not moving, and he started his engine. In that featureless vista, the sailboat seemed to almost grow in place like a sponge, absorbing water. Ed glassed it with his binoculars he'd inherited from his father and saw nobody on deck, so he cut his engine and kept some distance. Looked like a 40-footer. He stood, watching the thing, until he felt the backs of his legs starting to burn in the sun. The binoculars left red rings around his eyes. He started the engine and moved in closer. He held up some 100 yards out and gave it a moment, watching, before pulling up right alongside it. He Here he waited again and realized that he was not simply giving any occupants of the other boat ample opportunity to respond. He was in fact begging them to do so. They declined. He had a nasty sickness in his stomach looking at the thing, and it only grew the closer he came to it. Working carefully, he pulled himself near enough to jump across, and with a quick knot, he secured the two vessels. He was left face to face with the cabin door and again found himself waiting. Waiting on someone else to resolve the situation, to absolve him of the responsibility to go any farther. To take the choice and agency out of his hands. No one appeared to do so. He tried the door and found it unlocked. He opened it a crack and paused, scrunched up his features and waited for the blast. Waited for hot buckshot splintering the door and through his abdomen. It never came. He should have said something, should have called out a greeting, identified himself. But he could not speak. He opened the door wide. Nobody was inside, that much was clear at a glance. But he checked the closets to be certain, and under the bed twice. The bed was unmade, but the room itself was not especially messy. There were white sheets draped across the windows and covering the vanity and the mirror above the headboard. As the details came into focus, he realized there were partly melted candles scattered around almost every flat surface in the room, and there was a whiff of something lingering in the background, and he put his thumb on it. Gunpowder. He moved on to smaller spaces, the places where a human body could not hide or be hidden. Cabinets, drawers, socks, combs, and hair gel. Hold on. Flash of gold. A watch band. Heavy thing. A Rolex. His heart stuttered forward and knocked the breath out of him so that he had to go chase it down. He looked around and thought about checking the closets again. He touched the back walls. Trapdoors? He walked a U around the bed, tapping the floor with the toe of his shoe. It all sounded solid. He went above board and looked out at the sea and scratched the back of his head. The sun was high in the sky. The water calm and empty. He went back into the cabin and searched the rest of it and did not find anything so remarkable as the watch. He picked it back up out of the drawer and held it in his hand and tried it on. He scratched his chin. He went and squatted on the deck, watching the clouds move across the sky. And then he sighed and stood up and went back into the cabin and left the watch in the drawer where he had found it. He uncoupled the boats and motored away. He was content when he could no longer even spot the sail on the horizon and dropped anchor for the evening. He opened a beer and put out his lines and set up a canvas on his easel and painted until the sun dipped beneath the horizon. He sat out on the deck drinking until late into the night. And all evening, time and again, his thoughts returned to the watch. In the morning, he turned himself around and headed back in the direction he'd come. Fleeing the rising sun until he saw the sail rising out of the dawn mist and made for it. He pulled confidently alongside and lashed the pair together again and boarded. He went straight to the cabin. It was dark inside and he let the door close behind him. He had the drawer open before he suspected that anything was wrong. He hesitated and turned around. There was someone in the bed. Ed's face went slack. His legs too heavy to lift. He stood in the dark, not moving, hardly breathing for 10 minutes, watching the gray light slowly build. His eyes adjusted. The figure in the bed did not move. Ed listened for breathing above the sounds of the ocean. Finally, the light was enough that he could make out the figure in the bed as a man. His eyes were closed and his head was tilted back at a severe angle. Ed approached the man's bedside and did not take his eyes from him. He waited and waited until it was little more than a formality when he took the man's wrist in his fingers. He was dead. His skin was cold. There was no mark visible on the body to tell how he died. Ed searched and searched again for a pulse to be sure. There was none to be counted. He checked and checked again. The man was dead. His body was stiff. Ed went back to the drawers and removed the watch and placed it on his own wrist. The man did not protest. He stepped out of the cabin into the blinding sunlight, and after his eyes adjusted, he unhitched the two boats and soon left the sailboat somewhere behind the horizon to his stern. After he ate, he did not feel like painting or even fishing, so instead he stripped off his clothes and jumped off the side of the boat, which over the course of several days had begun to feel almost like a prison cell. He swam around for 20 minutes and broke the slowly suffocating illusion that this little boat was the entirety of existence. He laid on the deck afterward, drinking a beer and letting the sun dry him. He'd left the watch on his own vanity, and it almost looked more impressive there on the walnut than it did on his wrist. He tore open a bag of pretzels and spent the afternoon painting. He stopped when he realized he was spending more time looking at the Rolex than the canvas. What had come over him? He'd never been an ultra-materialist. The thing had his hooks in him. It was perfect. When he lay out on the deck reading before dinner, he spent comparatively little time reading and most of it picturing himself, what he must have looked like on the boat, in his watch. It was the type of thing people would ask about. He'd need a story. He drank a beer while he grilled and ate sausages again and waited for the stars to appear, but they never did. Cloud cover had moved in right at sunset and showed no intention of leaving. And the darkness that reigned below was unfathomable, a darkness to sit on your chest and knock the air from your lungs. It made him uncomfortable in his skin, and he went below deck and closed the curtains and sat down with his book. The sound of the water against the hull eased him and reminded him that the world still existed out there in all that dark. The following morning broke gray and foggy. Fog so thick he was once again questioning if the rest of the world was still out there. The sun was a pale spot squatting just above the horizon. He was nearly on top of it before he saw the sailboat, like it materialized right there out of the mist. He narrowly avoided it, and as he floated past, confirmed beyond any doubt that this was the same boat. The deck was empty. Perhaps he'd gotten turned around in the fog. Or perhaps the other boat had. But how does a boat with no captain and no destination go the wrong way? Despite the warm air, Ed suddenly felt very cold. He could board it again. No. Just the thought made him nauseous. He lingered nearby for several minutes to see if anyone would appear on deck. Nobody did. He sailed away, putting as much distance between himself and the boat as he could before stopping for lunch. He was sitting up at the bow, squinting off at the horizon, eating a sandwich, and his heart was finally relenting. His forearms were aching for how hard he'd gripped the wheel all morning, and he got an upside-down feeling in his stomach when he realized how far he'd come. Well past the comfort level for the amount of fuel he was carrying. At least 50 miles farther than he'd calculated for by his rough estimation. He'd almost certainly, at a bare minimum, be getting back a day later than planned, maybe two. His wife would worry. Who cares? She'd live. His heart was really beating again. You're retired. At least only worry about important things. He'd almost certainly be dipping into what he'd considered emergency reserves, but that was okay. That's what it was there for. He could always find an island and buy enough to get him home if he had to, probably. He wasn't exactly an expert navigator, and the whole morning had flown past in a half-conscious blur. The important thing was not to panic. Sure, this was still a leisure trip. He should still take time for leisure. His heart was slowing. He just had to be, what was the word? His mother used it all the time. Cognizant, right? He tried to read, but only fell asleep. And when he awoke, it was with a smarting sunburn across his face and stomach, except for where Anna Karenina had fallen. It was half dark, and he judged it 6:30 or even 7, but checked his watch and it was only 3. Had his watch stopped? No. He turned around and saw a wall of weather, not only chasing, but bearing down on him. He thought it might have been the fog he'd left earlier, but it was more than that. He could see lightning flashing in the gray. It was a vivid gray that instilled a hot flash of panic in his chest. Already the waters were getting choppier beneath him. The thing moved silently, clouds churning and spinning like cream and coffee, devouring everything. He motored ahead, cutting northeast and glancing every few moments back over his shoulder to see if he was on the verge of outflanking it. It seemed to go forever. It was hard to tell what was real night and what was the storm, but soon it was dark, and then it was very dark. He sailed and sailed, looking for cover, and no matter how far and how hard he pushed, there was only more open water. Soon, it overcame him. He began to roll in the swell. Lightning flashed noiselessly overhead. The wind came and went, always howling, but his boat seemed hardly touched by it, as if the wind were working nearby, then farther, farther still, then nearer, then right on top of him to hear it, but the hair on his head hardly fluttered. And every so often a spit of spray would catch him across the cheek, but the principal feature of the thing seemed to be the darkness and the noise. The darkness and the noise, and the silence beneath the noise, beneath the wind, whenever it retreated, like the whole world was being smothered, and the storm was only a passing veneer, a shadow play chimera sent to cover the true depth and nature of the void beneath it all. Some form of void felt very near, in his stomach. He could understand how a body might think there was simply a shelf at the end of the world, above oblivion. Several times, he stuck his finger into his ears trying to dig out whatever cotton must have surely been lodged in there, only to find his hearing ways totally unobstructed. All that sloshing in the dark made him sick, and he lost it over the starboard side. But soon the storm was past, the water calming by the minute, and the blanket dark lifted. But the stars never appeared. The clouds had arranged themselves in such a fashion as to trick the eye into perceiving that there were no clouds at all, and that the stars and the whole night sky had simply been erased. By midnight, the sea around Ed had calmed to a resolute stillness and crypt stone silence. Nothing like sleep approached him, but he lay all night in bed waiting patiently regardless. For several hours, the fear burrowed into him that he would never see the sun again. Such was the darkness in the sky. He lay, sweating and twisting one leg in, one leg out of the sheets, staring at the little windows along the top of the cabin. The problem was that it had no depth. The darkness. The sky. It was as if the world had been removed from everything. But somehow dawn came, and the sun rose, shimmering and grapefruit marvelous, the eastern sky victorious in clementine. As the minutes passed, the angle of light changed, and the horizon solidified from the haze, and the sailboat appeared there as if out of thin air. Ed set the sun to his stern and sailed back the way he'd come. The western sky was growing lighter by the minute, and when he looked back over his shoulder, the sailboat was nowhere to be seen. He checked the gas gauge. It would be close. There was no wind, not a cloud in the sky. The water was dead and lifeless beneath him. He could feel it. So deep it made him dizzy just to think of it. He passed all the morning, with the sound of the engine chuttering in his ear, and he did not stop for lunch, but pushed onward as the sun came around over his head and began falling into his path. It was a long way back, but he breathed easier with his prow pointed west. By sunset, he'd nearly convinced himself that he had overreacted. A pair of gulls flew by overhead and once called out, and his heart fluttered. He opened his last beer and started the grill and tried the radio again. He should have been close enough to pick up something. Radio waves travel farther over water. Nothing. Several times he almost caught something, but each time it slipped through his fingers like the water. Maybe he was still farther out than he'd thought. The The sea beneath him was a mass grave. He was in over his head. He suppressed the thought. No panic. He was in over his head. What a predictable, pathetic, cautionary tale he would make. Overconfident neophyte buys a boat and a captain's hat and sails off the edge of the earth, never seen again. Swing and a miss. An unforced error. An elaborate suicide. No. No. He had fuel. He would not let all of his life be crystallized as an object of pity. How many generations until it was open practice amongst the family to snicker at it? 3? 2? Remember when Grandpa accidentally sailed his boat out into the ocean and then ran out of gas and died? No. It did no good for him to work himself into a state. Who cared? He wouldn't be around to hear their snickering. It was only him and the boat. The only pathetic thing would be to give up. The next day, the wind was at his back, and he did his best to ride the current, watching the fuel gauge crawl down. He wished he knew if there was such a thing as a most efficient speed. He guessed that there must be, but he could only go by the sound that it made. The humming was familiar to him by now. His ear was untrained, but he could pick out a bad note. He stood watching the sunset, feeling his heart. When several minutes had passed, he concluded that he'd headed off a panic attack. He ate his dinner in an optimistic mood and managed to carry it all the way till the time he went to bed. He read more of his book than he'd managed in the entire trip to that point, and he felt he was finally enjoying it rather than fighting it. He woke in the morning with the sunrise and went out of his cabin nude, and there was a green balloon floating across the sky over his head. How long did helium usually last in those things? He hadn't even a guess. A day? A week? Both seemed equally plausible. And above it, way above it, was a cloud like the trail of an airplane. That's what those were, right? Clouds didn't naturally form that way, did they? He scanned the horizon and saw no plane. He listened as though he might hear the land. Traffic and radios and people talking, shouting. Garbage trucks backing up. As far as he reached, there was only silence. Only the lapping of the water. As if he were alone in some great cosmic bathtub. He made breakfast and coffee and did not rush. Maybe he would find Florida in an hour with a quarter tank of fuel and be bitter that he had allowed himself to be scared into cutting the trip short with all his fretting. He allowed himself this thought. And then he plowed ahead, fleeing the fast-rising sun, feeling his bare back begin to bake. It made him feel alive, and he was glad to feel it. His nerves got the best of him, and he plowed right through lunch. And in the evening, the gas gauge seemed to drop faster than the sun. At night, he glassed the horizon with his binoculars, looking for lights, and found none. He went to bed early because he could not do anything else for worrying, and sleep was slow in coming and uneasy when it did. He dreamt of his honeymoon, a briny seaside hotel on the foggy central California coast. He and his wife were swimming at a secluded section of beach, a little alcove they'd found for lunch that was all their own. They took off their clothes when the sun set, and the last light of day was glowing tangerine over the water. They hadn't seen another soul all afternoon, and had noticed the silhouette of a man standing atop a rock at the end of a spit that jutted some way out into the water, watching them. He acted as though he hadn't noticed, and then when he was near enough to his wife, he informed her. He didn't see it in the dream, but he remembered how it had happened in real life. That night, they were driving to dinner several towns up the coast, and the moon was out over the water, keeping pace. Ed brought up the man at the beach, the watcher. His wife mentioned matter-of-factly that he had been no more than 2 feet tall. Ed said that was crazy, but his wife was absolutely certain. She claimed that he'd misjudged how far they were from the rock formation. It was one of the little people they'd seen. She claimed to have seen one once before, when she was a child. He woke and it was still dark. From where his head lay sweating, he could see the thin crescent moon framed in the cabin window. And there was noise. Faint, distant, but distinctly present out there in the nothingness. He threw on shorts and went on deck. The ocean dark was always a momentary shock to his system. He listened carefully. It was music. Trombone and clarinet, carrying over the water. Had he drifted in the night? Was he about to run aground on an island? Where were the lights? The trees, a denser dark than the sky? No, he was still at sea. But the music he had not imagined. It was a strange music, which seemed to consist of notes and intervals he had never heard in his life, and instruments seemed sometimes to play backward and upside down, and the unfamiliar scales caused a queer, rotten feeling in his stomach. Minutes passed, and he was near sure it was coming closer, coming in clearer. And he thought, at times, that it was almost starting to make sense. Then, when it was louder and clearer and closer than it had ever been, the music stopped. The clouds rearranged themselves and Ed could make out the sailboat, no more than half a mile or so in front of him. It silently closed the distance between them and passed within 30 feet of him. Ed was ready and heaved a rope at it. He pulled the two vessels together, scanning the opposite deck for any sign of life. There was none which he could detect. He boarded her and secured his line and explored topside, abandoned as ever. There was hardly a breeze to be felt, and yet the sails appeared full enough. He found himself standing in front of the cabin door, which felt distinctly alive and acutely present, as if it were examining its examiner. Even the stars seemed to have paused in their tracks to watch him. He didn't dare try the latch. He didn't know why he'd come aboard at all. Just the thought of the door opening was enough to make him lightheaded. And then, the boat exploded in sound. It walloped him, square on. A big band. Big brass, horns and bass punched him in the face, coming from behind the door, coming from the cabin. Trumpets nearly knocking his teeth out. It was no record, no sound system. It sounded as if Count Basie's entire orchestra were somehow crammed down there, and not just the musicians, but an entire club. Waitresses and glasses clinking and patrons laughing and coughing and mumbling away at each other in the background. The sound emanated from the whole cabin, filled the whole space. Yet there was no shaking of the floor, no light coming from under the door. The fisherman's feet were affixed. The water was calm. He looked back at his boat, and a moment before he did, he had a vision that he would see himself standing there already, like he'd somehow been left behind. He did not. There was no one. Only his empty camp chair, which he'd not used for fishing in 3 days. The music carried out over the dead and dark water for miles, and the party carried on and on into the night, the devouring darkness, and bound it there, to a point of unimaginable density. A funeral ship for the world. A week later, Ed's boat, time at last, was spotted by Coast Guard helicopters off the coast of St. Augustine, out of fuel and stranded. It was close enough to hear people playing volleyball on the beach. Ed was not with it, though all of his possessions were still where he had left them. The gentleman who bought the boat at auction was dismayed to find a small but not insignificant leakage in one of the fuel lines. Ed was never seen again.
The Dying Cowboy, I learned this from a boy in Idaho, Brown Martin. Oh, bury me not on the lone prairie, where the coyotes howl and the wind blows free. In a narrow grave, just 6 by 3. Oh, bury me not on the lone prairie.
These words came slow but mournfully from the valley and lips of a youth who lay on his golden bed at the close of day. Oh, bury me not on the lone prairie, where the wild coyotes will hollow me, where the cold wind sweeps and the grasses wave, no sunbeams rest on the prairie grave. He has wasted in pine till o'er his brow his shadows slowly gathering. He thought of his home with his loved ones nigh, as cowboys gathered to see him die. Again he listened to well-known words, to the wind's soft sigh and the song of birds. He thought of his home and his native bowers, where he loved to roam in his childhood hours. I've often wished that when I died, my grave might be on the old hillside, that there's a place of my last rest be. Oh, bury me not on the lone prairie. O'er me slumbers a mother's prayer, and a sister's tears will be mingled there. Yet to know that the heart drops o'er, and that its fountain will gush no more.